Here at Early Excellence, we specialise in early childhood education. We offer expert advice and guidance through training, consultancy and classroom design. With the Early Excellence podcast, we aim to inspire and support you as well as challenge your thinking. So if that's what you're looking for, you've come to the right place. Hello everybody, Andy Burt here. We're taking a break from recording new episodes of the podcast at the minute, but we will be back with new Early Excellence podcast episodes in September. Until then, we'll be re-releasing some of our favourite episodes from the year so far. So here's my Early Excellence podcast chat with Ben Kingston Hughes as we explore why children need joy. Hello, Ben. Nice to see you. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you. Very busy, which is brilliant. Very tired, which is not quite so brilliant. But yeah, that's the job, isn't it?
Yeah. We were just chatting just before, weren't we? And I think between us, I think we probably clock up a fair number of mile, I should think, getting up and around the country, I would think.
Yeah, I need to do, isn't it? It's a privilege to be able to, you know, work all over the country. But sometimes at 4 a.m. when you're stuck on the M25, it can be a bit down. But no, it is a real privilege to do.
It is. Yes, it's a little bit like being on some sort of early years tour, I think.
Yeah.
Kind of stopping off in different places and presenting.
Yeah, there's been a couple of those coming up soon, actually, where they're calling it a road show. So there's a potential for one in Wales. It's not been confirmed yet. So it'll be multiple days all over Wales. And it'll be like just doing a play road show, which is a great idea. And then there's another idea to do that in the Newcastle area. So all around South Tyneside and the whole area. It's a huge area. So that's a great idea, isn't it? I haven't got a big double-decker bus. Otherwise, that would be a fantastic, you know, way to deliver the training. But no, it's a lovely idea.
Yes, it does conjure up for people of a certain age, the sort of the kind of Radio 1 road shows of back in the day.
Yeah, I've forgotten about those. Yeah. I did a radio show once years ago. I was a guest and I did a regular slot on the radio show. And at that age, my confidence at speaking was not brilliant. And I used to put on a radio voice because I thought that's what people wanted. And the guy who was the actual DJ had to take me to one side after about the second episode. He goes, "Why are you talking like that?" And I was doing that, "Hi, I'm Ben. How?" It's awful. And it just, that's what I thought DJs were supposed to talk like. It was only like a local radio show. It wasn't like a big, it wasn't Radio 1. But and I'm sure it doesn't even exist anymore. But yeah, I did this fake DJ voice because I thought that's what I was supposed to do. It's absolutely
that is
awful.
Brilliant.
Of course, it's a late night show and they did a competition because, you know, the radio shows give away free stuff. Nobody phoned in. So I don't know if anybody was listening. The head DJ guy got me to phone one of my mates because one of my mates is like, he's always up late, to make him phone in to get him to win the prize. So my housemate won a prize because he was the only person who phoned in, because at 1 a.m, nobody was listening to our radio. So I don't think it mattered that I was doing this really dodgy DJ voice whenever he spoke to me. But yeah, that was a long, long time ago.
That is absolutely brilliant. I had a kind of a radio kind of interesting run-in with radio as well, in that I was once asked to do to go on to a local radio show to talk about children's reading. It was when I was an early years teacher at the time, and it was within the local area. They'd run an initiative where they were giving out books to reception age children. And I think actually it was part of a national initiative, you know, so everybody got a sort of a treasure box with, I think, 2 or 3 books within them. And each year they were from a different author. And this particular year they were Alan Alberg books.
Oh, yeah.
So everybody got, I think it was Funny Bones in the box, the treasure box. And it was great. It was really well put together. And I was asked to talk on local radio about it, about what the children got in the pack and all of that kind of thing. And when I spoke to whoever it was that was setting up the show, they said, it's going to be you and Alan Alberg on the program.
Wow.
And I thought, blimey, that's amazing. You know, I had young children at the time, and I would, you know, I was obviously spending a lot of time reading to my children, and we loved Alan Alberg's books.
Yeah.
And so I got really excited and I gathered together all of my children's Allan Ahlberg books and I took them in and I got to the radio station. I sat outside the studio waiting to go in. In I went and the presenter talked a little bit about sort of, you know, what was coming up. And he said, in a few minutes, we're going to talk to Andy Burt all about reading. But here's the Detroit Spinners. Here are the Detroit Spinners. And then when the Detroit Spinners had finished, he said, so before we speak to Andy, let's talk to Allan Ahlberg. And Allan Ahlberg was just on the phone. He wasn't coming into the studio. And the penny hadn't dropped that that was what they were doing.
Yeah.
It never even occurred to me. And I was sat there like a Wally with a stack of Allan Ahlberg books for him to sign, and he was just on the phone.
I weirdly, you remind me, in my early days working with children, they did a road show around Leicester City, and it was I'm guessing it's Leicester Sound or one of the, but they went and visited children's projects. And they interviewed children and they were going, can anyone do any impressions? And one of the children said, oh, Ben can do Kermit the Frog. Because I used to do impression. I used to do Scooby-Doo for the children. I used to do Kermit the Frog. We're going back a minute now. But they've shoved the microphone in my face and said, oh, you can do a Kermit the Frog. And my voice cracked. And it's quite a definite impression when it works. It didn't come out anything like it because I was so put on the spot. It came out just a squeak. And you could see the light die in their eyes, the presenter go, oh, and then went on to another job. So somewhere I was, I can do, and I'm not going to now because I put pressure on myself, but I used to be able to do an impression of Kermit the Frog, but it was awful. It just went, hello. It was just horrible. So, So what could possibly go wrong?
Well, yeah, it is fabulous that you joined us again today. We talked, I think, about over a year or so ago. You came on the podcast and it was brilliant chatting to you then. And we talked all about, I think a year or so ago, we talked about the EYFS and why the EYFS is so important, why it's such a critical stage and how actually it needs to be celebrated. This time, of course, we're going to be talking all about something slightly different, although connected. We're going to be talking about joy. Since we met you last time, you have published a new book. You published Why Children Need Joy, and it's published last year. And so I was really keen, when I noticed that you got a book out, I was really keen to get you back on to chat about it. And so I was really interested, first of all, to find out whether there was a specific moment that kind of you thought, almost like a light bulb moment where you thought, yeah, that's my next book. That's what I've got to write about. I've got to write about joy. Was there a moment?
Well, there were two, really, which is weird. I'd got some pressure to write a second book. And as most people know me, I'm a play specialist. So I'd written a book about play. There's not really any way you can go when you've actually written a book about your own specialist subject, the stuff that you've been passionate about for 30 years, etc. So I didn't envisage me writing another book, but there seemed to be that little bit of pressure to do it. People saying, oh, you're doing another book, because the playbook went down better than I could ever have imagined. It was, you know, I'm not a writer, but that's not what people would have thought of me. And I wrote it as in a very conversational style. I didn't want it to be a textbook. So I thought people were going to hate it, genuinely. And then I've got this pressure to write another book. I thought, well, I don't have another book in me. I'm a play specialist. That's it. I'm done. And then a few things happen in succession. I do a lot of projects where I work with newly adopted children, helping them bond with their new families. And that's a really lovely project. And you meet children who something's been missing from their lives, and it's something fundamental and really important. And then you meet these loving adoptive families who give that back. And for me, it's that concept of joy. And it can be anything from, you know, sharing, singing together to playing out in the woods together. But it's a moment when the child almost becomes a child again. So there's several different things. And there's some really quite heartbreaking things where we've worked with children who've been through more trauma in their short lives than I can even imagine. So I started to think about joy, and I thought, well, it's a bit obvious, isn't it? Surely it's going to be everywhere because it's so important. And I looked at the EYFS, and in the UK, the EYFS, the word joy is not mentioned once, not a single time. So then I was looking at things like development matters and characteristics of effective learning, and just looking at national curriculum, anything to do with working with children, the word joy was absent. But I kind of worried, and I you'll probably get this, that nobody's going to listen when you start talking about joy, because it sounds a bit nebulous and hippie-ish, doesn't it? That's what I was worried. I thought people would think I was having a midlife crisis and I turned into a hippie and was telling everyone to go hug a tree. And it was that kind of almost stopped me doing that. And then I was working on an adoption activity day, which is a lovely project. They were quite controversial when they first started. Really interesting project. We're actually helping find forever families for children in the first place. So children quite often have things on their profile that make them statistically harder to find a forever family for. And that can be anything from a disability or something like Down syndrome or a neurodivergent condition like ADHD. You can't lie. You know, you've got to tell, you can't just spring it on the adopters afterwards as a surprise. So there's lots of different reasons. So we do these events, which are just a party for children. That's all it is from our perspective. We've got no remit for adoption or anything like that. We are there purely for the children to have a good time. So we do loads of play stuff. We make loads of dens and we make magic potions. But adopters join in. And that's the beautiful thing. They subtly and tactfully join in the play. And if you're sat in a den with a little girl with Down syndrome making magic potions together, you're not seeing the Down syndrome, are you? You're seeing the real child. And these projects have now created more forever families than any other project that's ever been tried. So last year, so probably about a year and a half ago, there was a man, an adopter, with a young lad, probably about 4 years old, sat on his lap. So already this is a beautiful moment. Already this is making those wonderful bonds. So my staff are already starting to step back. And they've made a magic potion together. So it's basically food colouring and glitter. So it's very simple stuff. Sometimes we used to put vegetable oil in it. You don't do that when you've hired a school, because the mess that makes is unbelievable. So it is really simple, just food colouring and glitter. And they're sat there making the potion together, and already we're stepping back. But what the little boy doesn't know is that we've got a really expensive bit of kit that we bring. It's not at all. It's a torch in a box. So anyone that's had training with me, I bring my torch in a box. And it is just an old photocopier box. But I don't know if you can see this. When you put the potion on the box, it glows. That's all it does. And if you shake it lots, you get like a disco effect like that. So it's just that lovely moment. You know, when you say children's eyes light up with joy, well, that's literal, because they do. Well, the little boy had no idea that was going to happen. So he sat on the adopter's lap. He put it on the potion box, and it lit up. It was green food colouring. And he started shaking. And he started shaking like with excitement. And he shook so hard that he squeezed the potion. And of course, the lid popped off. It went all over. The adopter's just leaning in going, oh, that's amazing, straight in his face. So they're both covered in green food colouring. The adopter's got a white shirt on and he's going, oh, it does wash out, doesn't it? I'm going, yeah, of course it does. It doesn't at all. But there's a moment of presentation, and then they both burst out laughing. And it was just one of those beautiful moments. And at the end of the session, that was an expression of interest that we believe led to a forever family for that child. And that is a shared moment of joy. And that taught me it's not a made-up concept. It's not, nebulous. That is so real and visceral that child physically reacted to that moment. And then I went straight back that very same day and I put the proposal in for the publishers. The publishers loved it. They said, wow, this is so needed after COVID. And the rest is history. I wrote the book and it's now, bizarrely, a finalist for a Nursery World Award, which is incredible.
Oh, amazing.
For a kid with ADHD who was excluded from school for setting off fire alarms and was told by teachers that you're lazy and you'll never amount to anything. So, yeah, I mean, what an amazing journey. That was a long-winded way of saying, but genuinely, that's what inspired the book, just this moment over the potion technique. So, yeah.
But you're right, though. It's about relationships, isn't it? It is joy. But joy is a way of forming relationships, in that instance anyway, isn't it? And it's a bit like, if you think about families and families bonding, if you like, there are memories, there are joyful situations, there are things that we tell stories about, when we sit around the table at Christmas and we tell stories about, do you remember when this happened, or do you remember that? And we relay, kind of recall it together. There's a bond there, isn't there? And I guess you're talking about the early stages of that in that work.
Yeah. And one of the things I was looking at was the neuroscience of joy and the biochemistry of joy. And it's pretty much consistent that every positive, joyful experience, all of the biochemistry is enhanced if you share it with somebody that cares for you. And I think that is the absolute basis of it. And I did start to unpick joy as to the type of experiences that children need. So we could apply it in a concrete way, not an abstract way. And one of the things that you have to feel is safe and important. You've got to be surrounded by other people in your life who make you feel cared for, because that is a foundation. If you don't do that bit, all the other experiences are not as powerful. So working with the newly adopted children, that if for those children, it's potentially the first time in their life that they feel safe and important. And so that is quite magical when you see these incredible adopters, and they give their lives for these children. They, you know, they age so much in the year, because I see them year in, year out. And that's not a criticism, because I love them to bits. But I think even they'll admit that the grey hairs, you know, and it's because they put everything into helping a child. And the children's behaviour can be negative. Of course it can, because of the adverse childhood experiences they've had. That you don't have those experiences without it fundamentally shaping your brain in negative ways. But these incredibly patient adopters just see through the behaviour to the child underneath. And it is the moments of joy that are so special. Can I share a quick project with you? All of you know this. Turns out working with children doesn't pay very well, does it? It's one of those things about, you know, it's such an underfunded area. But a lot of our children sessions run at a loss. So several of the ones, especially where we have to travel, we actually end up not making any profit or anything. We end up making a loss. But the last 2 years with book sales have been so successful that we've actually been able to fully fund some of our sessions, so the charities that we work for, their budgets have been slashed, so the session might not have been able to go ahead. So we've been able to fund it from Inspired Children. And so this summer we did an alpaca walk, and it was just a bunch of newly adopted children. Well, they weren't even newly adopted, actually. Some of them have been adopted for years because we didn't turn anyone away. And we just walked alpacas, and there's a unique joy. Because I've done work with alpacas before, but I was not sure if it would work. You know how when you try something, and they brought out the first alpaca to give the lead to a child, and you can't help smiling. There is something joyful about these fluffy creatures, and the look of awe and wonder on the children's faces. It was just incredible. And we had about 20 alpacas, and we just wandered off into the woods, with alpacas on leads. And they were just amazing animals. And the children bonded with the alpacas whilst with their families. So they were bonding with their families. And the best was feeding them, because they've not got teeth. They're not the children, the alpacas. And so they can't bite you, but they kind of scrape the food off your hands. It's a bit of a weird sensation. So the children are genuinely scared, like this. And then when they realize it's not going to hurt them, the joy for feeding an alpaca out of your hand. So yes, that was our very first ever completely free session, first of many. And we've got an idea to it with some children with Down syndrome, to take them with the walking the alpacas as well, because I think it'll be a really special experience for them. So that's joy, isn't it? The joy of alpacas.
Yeah, it's a joy. In funnily enough, though, in lots of ways, it's really simple, isn't it? That actually we're talking about doing things that you know actually will bring joy in some way, whether it be walking with alpacas or a visit to the farm or even just enjoying blowing bubbles or whatever it might be. It's something that is enjoyable, a shared experience. And yet, whilst it's at the heart of us thriving, you know, as human beings, we thrive when we have joy in something, don't we? We know that, you know, when you enjoy something and you have joy in an activity or an experience, we thrive. And we also know that we don't thrive when we don't take any joy from something. And so at its heart, we need joy, don't we? We need enjoyment and joy, but we don't talk about it. In education, we don't talk about joy. So I wondered whether you'd considered that when you were writing the book. Why is it we don't talk about joy? Is there a reason, do you think?
Well, I think it's what I said. I think it doesn't sound concrete enough. It's easy to talk about mathematics, isn't it? It's easy to talk about literacy, because these are concrete outcomes. The child is able to do this. So the experiences, the learning experiences that lead to that, they're quite concrete, aren't they? There are certain steps children need to go through. As soon as you start talking about joy, there's an element in society where they don't consider anything that's not outcome-led to be important. And in fact, even that you're somehow being a snowflake or, you know, so things like mental health issues for children get brushed under the carpet, because then they're not as real on the surface as, you know, as some of the other things that we work with children. So I think that's the biggest problem. Why? It's similar to play. It looks it looks silly, it looks nebulous, it can look frivolous. You know, if you've got a bunch of children, we threw paper airplanes off a tower, 30 children, 30 paper airplanes, we're on this climbing tower and we just threw them off. You know, joy, it was a sunny day and you just see 30 paper airplanes flying off and, you know, and that is a moment of joy. But a lot of people would be looking at that and just going, oh yeah, that's silly. Now let's get on with the real business of childhood. Let's get them sat at the tables doing their maths. And I think what I found through writing the book is actually that the joy underpins all the other stuff as well. So if you want a child to do well at maths, if that child enjoys it, they are have a considerably higher potential to be engaged in that maths. And it's not rocket science. We could all have told people that. But if we make learning experiences joyful, children automatically learn more. They become more capable. They assign more of their brain's resources to the task. That's one thing I found out. And they produce the most amazing biochemicals, some of which are addictive, which means you then start craving that learning experience. So I think what I've tried to persuade people in the book is it's not nebulous. It's not abstract. It's actually the foundations for all learning. And in early years, it is what we do, isn't it? We get children to develop communication language because we use joyful uses of language and that inspires them to learn it. So we do tongue twisters and silly songs and nursery rhymes and reading, you know, stories. But with joy, that inspires them to want to learn more language. But it also changes their brain so that they crave that experience. And then unfortunately, in this country, as children get older, it's in some areas of education, we make the experience unpleasant and then are surprised when the child learns slow. When actually, even a 16-year-old needs joy in a subject. You know, my son absolutely loved art and he was a really, really talented artist as a young child. He won a regional competition, but he dropped art at high school because they kept making him draw fruit and it bored him to death. You know, so that you take the joy away, you don't inspire learning, you actually get children to disengage.
I kind of feel like, from my point of view, education is made up of so much. But to me, the bottom line is that actually there's joy and enjoyment. It's almost, you know, that's the foundation of it. That's the start. That's your starting point. And if you do nothing else, you've got to have that in place.
Yeah.
Whereas it feels a bit like at times we put in everything else apart from the bit that is joyful and enjoyable. And then it kind of comes crashing down because we haven't got that strong foundation. And I think that is a real shame. I think we miss out on such a lot in terms of experiences and strong bonds and relationships between children and children and adults and children if we don't have those enjoyable experiences.
I think we make life choices, very important life choices based on that, because I do think we choose options at school, for instance, based on the lessons we enjoyed more because the brilliant teachers that we had that made it. I mean, I did chemistry because we had a chemistry teacher who would stand on the table and do the can-can singing songs about elements. And I never forget that. And in fact, you know, in your O-levels or GCSEs, if you remember the songs he sung, you now remember some of the chemical formula. And because he put joy into it. And I think I thought I was the only person banging on about that. And it actually turns out I found some quite interesting research in education. There was one in particular, if anybody wants to look this lady up, Dr. Judy Willis, who promotes joyful approaches to education. But what she's done is she's backed up every one of her assertions with multiple neuroimaging studies. And what she's almost saying is that these are not just good ways to educate. This is the best way. This is the best way to get your child to be the most capable, to enjoy the learning, so want more of it, but also to succeed the best as well. And it's based on very simple neuroscience, very simple biochemistry, but it's basically joyful experiences of education, access more of the brain. They give you more focused attention. They produce biochemicals that make you desire that more. So your capability increases, your desire increases, and it's a spiral. You keep going up and up and up. And if you imagine a maths lesson where children are craving maths like a heroin addict craves heroin, you know, that's lifelong learning, isn't it? That's how children should be. And according to Dr. Judy Willis, we can do that now. We actually now know that is how children learn the best. It's if they experience a fundamental joy of whatever it is. Novel experiences is something I wrote about as well, where things are surprising, where you're not expecting it. So that awe and wonder that we do in early years, that massively increases production of a chemical called dopamine, which is a really feel-good hormone. But it is massively ramped up, which is why when, you know, it's why jokes work, because you're not expecting the punchline. The punchline makes you go, ha, ha, yeah. And that is a massive flood of dopamine. So that's why using humor when you're educating, helps children to be more capable, because again, dopamine is, it all doesn't just make you feel good, it also is a catalyst for other chemicals that increase your focused attention on the subject. So if you do jokes, in fact, I have recommended that all secondary school teachers have mandatory stand-up comedy training, because it massively improves learning. I don't know how well that one will go down. But yeah, it's across the board, and there is research on it. It's just you have to find it. So yeah, fascinating stuff.
Yeah. So yeah, it does make complete sense. Complete sense, without a doubt. You're absolutely right. I think joy is something that is so important. It is absolutely a foundation. But there's also more than that as well, in that it also, I think, and I think that you bring this out, in that this comes through in your work, that joy is also linked to child development and to the areas of learning as well as that. So there's kind of almost two strands. It is the foundation where we form those relationships and we decide whether we enjoy a subject, an experience, et cetera, and whether we want to invest more in it.
Yeah.
But it's also linked to child development as well. And I wondered about, you know, communication and language development. You know, if we're talking about enjoying things, and that's as adults and children, and adults and children together, then enjoyment and joy can clearly be linked to communication and language development.
Yeah, but again, I think we've previously been going that it's a nice thing for children to experience, and almost kind of, you know, shelving it as an optional extra to childhood. But actually, it's a fundamental foundation for communication language. And you only need to look at the children that I work with who've not had any joyful language. You know, the children that have been told, you know, no, or even worse, you know, not just the negative language that all parents have to use once in a while, you know, stop hitting your sister, get your finger out of the plug socket, but the, you know, the downright nasty language that they've heard. If you look at a child who's had all joyful language removed from their life, it's almost guaranteed that child's going to struggle with their communication language themselves, because now joy itself has become a negative, now language itself has become a negative construct. So there is now no motivating force to want to learn more of it. And you only need to look at the word gap, and you look at children who are struggling, and it is a national, you know, it is a national problem. Look at what's missing. You analyze their home lives and you look at what's missing from those children's lives, and it is bedtime stories. You know, that unique moment of joy between parent and a child. It's songs, it's tongue twisters, it's the silliness. And it, again, on the surface, these things might not look important, but in almost every case of where a child is struggling with their language, if it's not for a medical reason, if it's purely experiential, it tends to be because they've not had those joyful experiences. So if you work with children, giving those joyful experiences back can be the most important thing you ever do, because what it's going to do is give that child that, oh, wow, do you know what? These words can be fun. These words can be used in a good way, not in a way to hurt. And it's, yeah, it's massive when you can get somebody telling stories and putting on all the voices and, you know, doing all the funniness and making the Wicked Witch really funny. You see children's rapt attention at that. That's not a child who's disengaging in communication language. So I think joy is a fundamental building block for all of it. I do a whole bit on music, a whole chapter, because I think musical experiences are so important for children developing communication language. And it turns out there's some really interesting research on it. I didn't realize quite how much there was going to be. I don't know if I've told this story before, but I did I was asked to do music training. And just before this, Andy and I, we were talking about times we died on stage, weirdly. But this was another one. This was Milton Keynes asked me to do music training. And before I went in, all the people that were waiting, 30 people, nobody chatted at all. It was complete silence, and I can't sing a note. I am a terrible singer, but because I was doing music, I always believe that you shouldn't make learners do something if you're not prepared to do it yourself. So I'd prepared some songs, and I was nervous already because I genuinely can't sing, and I launched into the first song. Not one person joined in. It was just agonizing. Honestly, if I could go back in time and tell myself, whatever you do, Ben, don't do the rap, honestly, I would. The joy of music and singing is off the scale. But so human beings have not got great hearing compared to other mammals. So dogs and cats have got, you know, way, way better hearing than us. Some of them have got 10 times the level of hearing. But your dogs and cats can't distinguish between the subtle tones of human speech. So we have got worse hearing, but we've got better focus, if that makes sense, because we can distinguish finer tones. And it's called auditory discrimination and phonological awareness. And that is the way we can actually work, you know, we can actually listen to and understand highly nuanced human speech. So what, how you develop that is the interesting bit, because it turns out that musical experiences are not just a nice way to do it. Again, they're a fundamental foundation. The early musical experiences you have as a baby and through early years, they're what actually train your hearing and your auditory centers of your brain to be able to distinguish those tones. And until you learn that, you can't replicate the speech. So you can't learn to speak accurately until you've developed auditory discrimination. And music is such a fundamental building block that we now believe if a child is absent all of those musical experiences in childhood, they will be delayed with their speech because they've not been able to hear it accurately, so they can't replicate it. And there was one theory which I think is amazing. So anthropologists believe that musical experiences are so vital to the development of speech in human evolution that they must have predated speech. So before humans could even speak properly, we were still going around, cave people from 200,000 years ago going boo ba da ba ba boo boo boo, like jazz hands predate fire. That's what I'm trying to say here. And yeah, that's what a wonderful theory. And the theory, I mean, there were lots of theories. Some people said it might be to scare away a predator, but I don't think that theory is believed anymore, because I think you'd just roar, wouldn't you? I don't think you'd use music if you can shout and roar. So the well, you know, singing the Get Away From Me Cave Bear song, it's like musical theatre. But I think the main theory is that it's an extension of the soothing noises we made to babies, and that became music. So the very first musical notes were expressing your care and love for your family. So the very first songs were love songs. And if there's any baby room workers watching this now, you started it all. That's what started the whole of human civilization. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. And it also comes full circle, I think, doesn't it? In that you were talking about music there, but of course also for human beings, music brings joy. You know, without a doubt, you know, we talk about enjoyment. We talk about key moments in our lives. We talk about times we've really enjoyed. We think about soundtracks to it. You know, quite often there is a piece of music that links to our favorite experience, our most memorable moment that happened to us, you know, our key moment in our lives. There's often a song, whether you like it or not, there's a song that is the backdrop to it quite often. And I think we devalue that. We devalue that a bit, I think. I think we don't really value our creative arts and our music. But actually, you know, if you were to, you know, music is so fundamental, isn't it?
Yeah. As a totally unmusical person myself, I now see the value, and I, you know, I did bring in something to show you as well. We were talking earlier about not funny things, you know, about how people were talking to groups and saying, telling jokes that aren't funny. So this is mine. So one of the symptoms of ADHD, I was diagnosed 6 years, but one of the symptoms is that you keep doing the same thing that you think is funny, even though all the evidence tells you it's not. So one of the things I do when I'm training now, I tell them about the music and I tell them about the jazz hands predating fire. And then I said, but you probably think that's all conjecture. I said, I've actually got empirical evidence to show you right now. And that's where this comes in, because I then go, jazz hands dinosaur. And I show them a dinosaur doing jazz hands. Now, the occasional group I do that with, I get a little titter of laughter. But I've done that with groups and they've gone, oh. It's almost like they're going, but Ben, that's just a toy. That's not actual evidence. No. But this is the weirdest thing. This is my weird life. So I was doing a training course with Boogie Mites, who are a company that sells songs to nurseries and schools, and they're lovely. But they asked me to do a music course for them, but they didn't want me to do any singing because they do all the music, which is perfect for me. So I was like, yeah, that's brilliant. I'll do the neuroscience, you do the music. And I did that silly joke about the jazz hands dinosaur. Nobody laughed. But I then said, well, that'll make an interesting idea for a children's song. And Sue from Boogie Mites just went, well, you write the lyrics, we'll write the music. So the next day, I've got loads of work to do, didn't do any of that. I wrote a song about a jazz hands dinosaur, sent it off to them, didn't hear anything. So I thought, well, that was rubbish. 3 months later, I got an email and they've put music to it. They've put multiple voices, instruments, and they've produced the jazz hands dinosaur song. And they've done songs for Michael Rosen. You know, you were talking about Alan Alberg earlier. Yeah, Michael Rosen, they've actually done songs for it. So I've got my own song now, the least musical person on the planet. And we decided it would be free. to download because I didn't want to charge anyone for it. So people can now find on the website, if you go on my website or other websites, a Jazz Hands dinosaur song inspired by a really bad joke that I make on training courses. So that's my weird life. I'm now a songwriter. So, yeah, I think they've sold it as well to an American website. So there could be a potential for royalties on my very own song about the dinosaur. So, I tell you another lovely thing that inspired it. I'll keep this brief, but Dinosaur Makeover, if you've not tried this. So you get your toy dinosaurs and obviously children are playing with dinosaurs, but we do makeover. So we paint their nails, we get the children putting sequins on them, and we get them, you know, dressing them up in like small clothes and things. And that is a beautiful moment. And you can get a whole group of children doing a production line of blinging up all your dinosaurs. So that also inspired the song because he's a very blinged up dinosaur. All the other dinosaurs are stomping and roaring and being mean, whereas he's like just jiving through the jungle with his jazz hands and his sequins. So that's Jazz Hands Dinosaur. But yeah, do try Dinosaur Makeover.
It is another thing that brings joy, isn't it? I think that children find things that shouldn't go together funny. So there's a sort of surreal aspect of bringing together, you know, dinosaurs and makeovers or whatever it might be. You know, those books, those sort of flap books where the top half and the bottom half are different. So you kind of, you turn a page and then the bottom half remains the same. So you've got somebody who would be wearing something on the top half and then something completely different for the bottom half. Children typically find that sort of thing funny, that kind of playing about with roles or playing about with things that maybe shouldn't go together. They find that funny. There's an enjoyment in it. But also I think there's a shared enjoyment in it because often adults find that funny as well, don't we? You know, that kind of idea of things going together or not going together.
It's a very early type of humour. It starts early and goes all the way through our lives. It's based on incongruity. So babies, when they see something habitual in their environment, and again, there's a lot of research about how our brains automatically focus on that. But because it's surprising, so if you're an early years worker and you walk in with your underpants on your head, you'll get your children laughing, but you're also getting them producing more dopamine because the happiness is surprising or unexpected. So you've got, it's very, very rich in terms of the biochemistry, but it looks so silly, isn't it? It's just the making stuff up. It's just being as silly as you can. And, you know, a lot of jokes are based on you not expecting the punchline is what you didn't expect, or you're using a word in a different way. And that's quite advanced when you're using wordplay. But for children, it can be anything from, you know, my son put a potato on the cat's head and he laughed for hours about that. It was the funniest thing ever. So I think this is sacrilegious what I'm going to say now. I do apologize. But I think what an interesting version of the hungry caterpillar would be if instead of it turning into a butterfly, it turned into something different. Because I love The Hungry Caterpillar, but I've read it so many times. I mean, thousands in my career. I'm now over it. I'd quite like it to be not it turns to, but it turns into a rhinoceros. Just completely blow the children's mind. They're expecting it all the way through. And then it turns into an elephant and looks really surprised. But, you know, I'd love to see that, because that incongruity would delight your children.
Now, that again is very similar to telling a joke, isn't it? There's an unexpected punchline there. The structure of it is basically a joke, isn't it? The unexpected punchline is basically the last page of The Very Hungry Caterpillar when it isn't a butterfly. I think that's brilliant. We were going back, if that's all right, going back to, we were talking about child development, right? Communication and language, we've ticked that off. The next one is not as obvious, I think, but an interesting one. Physical development, linking joy and enjoyment to physical development.
Yeah.
Can you make that case?
Well, I think we already have, in a way. We've talked about, it's not even obscure. This is just simple facts. We now know that many children disengage in sport. Yeah, that's just one of those things about society. And it can be up to 70% of your children will disengage in sport. And there's only one reason. It's because the joy has been taken away, because they don't feel good about doing it. And sensible human beings will avoid a negative experience. That's not the child being lazy. That's not the child, you know, trying to get out of something. That is a sensible reaction. If something makes you feel humiliated or makes you feel not very good, then you will disengage. And I'm being brought in actually by a lot of sports agencies across the country to do work with people to get children back into physical activity. And we do it through joy. And it is the biggest catalyst. And we've talked about music. Well, what about dancing? You know, nobody's telling you you're in. I don't mean a dance class where you've got to do the exact right steps. I mean, you put on your favorite tunes and you just dance like you don't care. That is pure freedom, but it is more physical activity than, you know, than many sports lessons would get into a child. But at no point has the child felt like rubbish. At no point has the child feel humiliated. And if you do a mixtape of your children's music tastes, it's amazing because you could be dancing to Bangra Dancing 1 minute and then death metal the next and then country and western. You know, you could have this eclectic mix. And human beings moving to a beat is one of the most powerful things. Animals don't dance as much as people think, because although all of YouTube would seem to tell you otherwise, animals can't reliably keep to a beat. Only about 15% human beings are the only species that can reliably dance to a beat. So we get children physically active all the time, and we do projects with children who've already disengaged, and it's all about the joy. We don't worry about what they achieve. We don't worry about how good they are or how fast or strong. It's all about joy of movement. The best example of that, I think, is a water slide. If you ever watch a group of children, they will do a full sprint to go down the water slide, not because the adult's telling them to run, not because they're trying to learn a skill, but because it's more fun the faster you go. And we've worked with children who already are at risk of obesity. So whole groups of children we've been signposted to because of their lack of physical exercise and their potential health problems, but they are full sprinting to do the water slide. And it's pure joy. That's all it is. So I honestly think in terms of physical activity, it's the biggest catalyst. And I think if you don't enjoy it, a sensible human being disengages. So we've got to make all physical activity. I also think, I don't know if you agree, that sport is brilliant, by the way. Don't get me wrong. I'm not having a go at sport. But it tends to be done by people who are good at sport. And they tend to look like they're good at sport. So all of our sporting role models are, you know, ripped with, you know, thin, muscly, competent people. When if you actually look at humanity, more of us are not like that than are like that. So I think we need to reclaim sport for ordinary people. So I disengaged in sport as a child, not because I wasn't good at sport, but because I was incredibly short. And I know people find that hard to believe, because obviously I look about 6'4" now, but I don't. I was tiny as a child, genuinely tiny as a child. And so you can't compete against a child that's double your height. You can't run as fast as them. You can't. I remember throwing the javelin, and it was because I was so short, it would drag on the floor behind me. So I couldn't get any angle on it, and it would just go about 2 feet in front of me, and all the PE teachers would just laugh at me, and the whole group of 30 children laughing at me because I couldn't throw it more than a couple of feet. And so I totally disengaged in sport, because why would you do something that humiliates you? And I was incredibly fortunate. I discovered badminton when I was about 18, 19, and now I'm in my 50s. I play for a badminton team. I play every week, you know, twice a week, and I love it. Absolutely love it. I mean, we lose a lot. Don't get me wrong. We got beaten so much last season, but it's because I found something I could enjoy. How many adults are fortunate enough to do that? And again, you're 70% of children disengage in sport, and it's about 70% of adults that don't do enough exercise. So it's not a coincidence. And what those adults need is joy. And one thing we do on our parent play training, so we do play training for parents. If we do it face to face, we get them playing, and we get them playing games where it's all about the joy rather than who's won. And at the end of it, they're going, oh God, I didn't realize I was going to do so much exercise. But whilst they're doing it, they don't even know they're exercising, because they're running around with superhero masks on like this, pretending to be superheroes. So yeah, then we've used joy for a long, long time in terms of projects specifically tailored to get children physically active. And it's anything from music and dancing to skipping to. I saw a comedian the other day, and it was went out on Instagram, and he was saying that wouldn't society be better if we accepted skipping as a viable alternative to jogging? And he was saying, you know, people talk about a runner's high, and I'm sorry, I wish I could say this guy's name because I feel like I'm stealing his material, but he was brilliant. But he was saying, yeah, how long does it take to get a runner's high? And he was saying, well, nobody knows. It's just too far. Most people will never get a runner's high. He says, but how long do you have to skip for before you feel brilliant? It's like straight away. And he said people should be skipping around the neighborhoods as a way to keep fit, because you get an instant high from skipping. And he's right. It's joyful movements that would get us back into exercise. And we need to reclaim sport for the overweight people, for the short people, for the people who, you know, who've got two left hands like I have, you know, we need to reclaim it. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Have missed out on it. The other thing that strikes me as well is, I mean, we've talked about communication language, we've talked about physical development, we talked earlier on about relationships and social skills, etc., linked to joy. Right there, we've got the prime areas of learning. you've made a very good argument for each of the different, the three prime areas of learning, that each of them are basically underpinned by joy. And yet we don't talk, and yet, as we've already talked about, we don't talk about it enough. We've got the prime areas of learning, okay? What about the characteristics of effective learning? Okay, so we go from the different areas of learning to, you know, of course, the those different points of development to actually what underpins the learning process. And I had a look at the characteristics of effective learning, and I use them a lot as part of my training, of course. And I'd kind of thought that joy would be in there. And funnily enough, and there is one that kind of hints towards it, and which is children enjoy achieving what they set out to do. It talks about enjoying something. So enjoying achieving what you set out to do. And it's, but at the same time, it's not quite the same. It's similar, but not quite the same, isn't it?
And it's also focused on the end product, and that it's not saying children enjoy being children, or children enjoy the experience. And if we focus too much on the end product, we can actually lose the experience. And I think that's the danger with education, is that we focus too much on an outcome. We don't worry as much about how the children got to that outcome. And that means the child disengages. I've tried to make an argument that there should be a fourth characteristic of effective learning. I think joy is... I tried to break down joy in a way that's easily applicable to everybody. And I broke it down into three experiences. And if you look at the characteristics of effective learning, all of them are enhanced by the three experiences. So the first one is obviously your happiness. If you're happy, we know that you are in a good place for learning. It's, you know, children who are unhappy automatically learn slower simply because the brain is not in the right setup for that experience. But there's also got to be high levels of engagement. Joyful experiences are not the meh moments. They're the "this is the best day ever" moment. And then you've got to feel safe. You've got to feel important. And it's, you know, back to your Harlow's monkeys experiments, where the monkeys that didn't feel safe with a caring other monkey didn't even explore. They just sat in a corner and rocked. Whereas the monkey that felt safe would be into stuff, would be investigating and playing. So all of your characteristics are enhanced by those three experiences. And it isn't just the end product, it's the whole experience needs to be joyful. So yeah, I tried to make an argument at the end of the book that joy is the fourth characteristic of effective learning, that every other one of them, and you know, the characteristics are backed up with some really solid neuroscience. They're really, you know, they are spot on in terms of learning. It's a shame we don't keep those all the way up until secondary, because it would make a massive difference to children learning. Yeah, they do need that one, that fourth. What I've said to people is that they need to sneak into their settings in the middle of the night and graffiti the word joy at the beginning of that, at the end of that document. And I've said, you know, don't get caught, wear a fake beard or eye patch or whatever it is and graffiti it. And then I said, well, don't leave it there. Put it on your parent notice board, put it on your staff notice board. You know, get a tattoo done with the word joy, because it's absent and it shouldn't be there. A few people have taken me up on that. There's been some other people who work in the industry who have started writing it in settings and things, just like graffitiing the word joy. So hopefully I've started a spate of graffiti of that word. But yeah, I think
it also made me think that we've talked about joy in children throughout this, when actually it's not just about joy within the children, is it? It usually, when we have an effective setting, when we have an effective learning experience, it's not just the children who are enjoying it, but the adults as well. And that there is they are joining in something which is joyful. And therefore, that's not just about creating something you think, well, the children will enjoy this, and then I'm standing back. It's actually about thinking about the role of the adults and about the adults. Are the adults enjoying the company of the children? Are the adults enjoying being alongside the children, engaging with them? And we probably don't talk about that enough. We talk about communication and language skills, and are you engaging in communication and language with your children? We probably take it just as a given that actually the adults need to be enjoying the experience of being alongside the children. But we don't talk about
it. No, and we've all worked in settings where occasionally people have forgotten to tell their faces to smile. You know, and by not smiling when you're with the children, you're actually showing them that they're not important to you. The smile is one of the first forms of visual nurturing, because babies, you know, recognize faces very early on. And when that's absent, you're already taking the joy away. And I think we've got an opportunity, every adult, to be any role model we want to be for children. We can choose what we want our children to be getting from us. And many adults choose mean or disinterested. So I think if you work with children, we've almost got to counter those by being more joyful, more cheerful, more happy. I also think sometimes we need to throw the rule book out the window and just plan for joy. So I know obviously the EYFS, you know, it's very important to a lot of the earlier settings. I know that you're looking at your development matters and you're looking at the next steps, but sometimes just take a step back and go, right, let's just do something because it's amazing. Let's do something because it's epic, because it's going to give those children joy. Let's just do something because it's funny and it's going to make our children laugh. I think sometimes we need to take the foot off the gas and go, right, joy is as important as any of the other things that we're doing with children. So let's give some time for it, because then I think you'll get some thriving children. Interesting research in Warwickshire. They've done a psychological study of post-COVID children, and some quite damning stuff in there, because obviously children are struggling. You know, children's mental health is at crisis point. Do you know what their top recommendation, or one of the top recommendations of this psychological study was? More giddy time. And they've actually used that word, giddy. I mean, how amazing. And it's proper psychologists who've done the work. It's, you know, it's a very interesting study. But yeah, more giddy time. We all need more. And I think some adults think that's like,
I'm all for more giddy time.
Yeah, definitely. I think adults, we all need more giddy time, don't we? So yeah, I think some adults would crush that behaviour. And actually, that's what children need to help their mental health in a post-COVID world, more giddy time. Unfortunately, I only learned that after the book was published. Otherwise, I'd have included giddy time as one of their titles for one of the chapters, because I think how we can get children to get that wonderful giddy excitement is such a joy when it works. So yeah.
But you do talk in the book about the impact on society as a whole, though, if we do make sure that we have that joyful childhood. And I think that is really interesting, that actually, I think in early education, we quite often talk quite short term. We talk about preparing reception children for year one, you know, are they year one ready, you know, et cetera. But actually the impact of effective early years practice goes way beyond just being ready for year one, doesn't it? Or even, you know, even key stage two or secondary school, it goes way beyond that. And I think when we're talking about a joyful childhood and about those levels of engagement that are generally linked to that, the impact on society is great, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've been recently weirdly just written some pre-recorded training that was originally supposed to be school readiness, but we didn't want to call it school readiness, we wanted to call it life readiness, but it ended up being called Capable, Confident and Ready for Life. So we've created a quite an intensive full day pre-recorded online training, and I said to the people who commissioned it, I said I want to do a whole module on joy, because I think in terms of life readiness, we're way past the old idea where if you give children negative experiences it somehow toughens them up. Yeah, that is not one single shred of evidence backs that up. There is not a single study that backs that up. Whereas what we're actually looking at is if you give children positive, joyful experiences in early childhood, it gives them the armor so that they can have the resilience to protect them against the other rubbish that life is going to throw their way. So actually, these are more than just a nice way of working. They're more than just, oh, you know, let's get our children ready for reception class. These are the fundamentals for life. A child that has a joyful childhood has a much, much higher chance of thriving than a child who doesn't. And I know this for a fact because I work with the children that haven't had that joyful childhood. I work with children who have had literally everything taken away from them by adults. And when you see a tiny moment of joy, how profound it is for those children, think about the children that actually get that as their standard life experience when they go to early years, when they're you know, in their own home, if they're experiencing joy, that's armor that will protect that child for life. And I really do believe that if we could create a society where every child experiences joy, I think we have a better society. And there's some incredible epigenetics research which shows that early childhood experiences change the genetics of your children. It actually switches on and off different markers in the DNA. That means if you give children positive experiences in early years, it actually shapes their DNA. So the benefits are passed on to their unborn children 20 years from now, children you might never meet. So it's not just the child you're helping. In fact, studies in rats, it was shown to be a minimum of two generations of impact. So every time you create joyful experiences for your children, you're potentially helping their unborn grandchildren to have better prospects for emotional well-being and mental health. So it's not even just society as a whole. It's years in the future, joyful experiences for children are going to have an impact. So, yeah.
That's absolutely mind-blowing, isn't it? It really is absolutely mind-blowing. Ben, I love chatting to you. The work that you do is brilliant, and it absolutely strikes a chord with me, and I'm sure will strike a chord with so many people out there, which is why your books have been so successful. When do you know about the Nursery World Award?
It's not far. It's quite soon. I have to say I'm not massively hopeful because all the other books look very sensible and serious. Mine's the only one that's whimsical, although it's got a very serious message. And also I can't make it to the ceremony, unfortunately. I'm really annoyed. But I've got a children's session in Macclesfield. It's just too far for me to get from Macclesfield to London. So I don't know if that affects your chance of winning if you're not there at the awards ceremony. But yeah, I'm not massively hopeful, but I am incredibly privileged and pleased to be on the finalist list. It was just lovely to be recognised. It's just a very odd, whimsical book.
Can I put in a cheeky request?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And that is if you do win the award,
yeah,
and they ask you to put together one of those kind of presentation videos where you accept the award from somebody and it's on screen and it's like a recorded version of it. Can I present you with the award?
Absolutely, yes. I've been up for a Nursery World Award for training, and they got me to do in advance an acceptance speech. So I thought that meant I'd got a good chance of winning. I didn't. So this time they haven't asked me to do a video for an acceptance speech. So now I'm assuming that means that I haven't. So, but that was an online conference, though, so I don't know whether it's different. But yes, absolutely, if I do. Can I pitch something to you very quickly?
Far away.
So I love your podcast, and I'm guessing you're surprised by how, when you first started, by how many people, you know, go on about your podcast. It's a great podcast. And doing the stuff with you, we always look at the lighthearted stuff, but a lot of the other podcasts, it's very serious, and there's nothing wrong with that because there are a lot of serious issues. So I'm going to start my own podcast, and I'm going to do it all about the lighter side. And I would love to invite you to come and speak just about funny experiences of working with children or even training. And it's not laugh out loud funny. I'm not putting pressure on people to be hilarious, but it's just the lighter side of working with children where we don't cover the big issues. And it's just something free to give back to the sector, just a way of, you know, you can certainly promote your work, you can do anything you want as part of it, but it is just, you know, what are some funny examples of you working with children? Or I ask random questions as well, like what was the naughtiest thing you ever did as a child? You know, little things like that. And it's just a way to give back to the sector. And I've got some quite big names have agreed to do it already. And breaking news, I've already filmed the first episode, which I'm not going to release until after Christmas, but it was with Greg Bottrell, who is another play specialist, absolute legend of a guy. So if you were up for that, no pressure at all.
I'm well up for that then.
But yeah, I think we'd
get, yeah, absolutely. I'm absolutely well up for that. Yeah, I've got loads and loads.
I thought you might have that would be brilliant
to hear. Yeah.
The earliest funny side is the provisional title for it. So EYFS, but the earliest funny side. And I'm going to put it out just free, just for people to get a bit of a laugh or a bit of just some uplifting stuff. So yeah, and you'd be amazing on.
We need it. We do need it, don't we? We definitely need it. Ben, I would love to do it. I would absolutely love to do it. Yeah, count me in. Count me in. It has been brilliant to chat to you again. I knew it would be. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. And yeah, all the very best with the Nursery World Award.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. But all right, well, lovely to see you again. And yeah, I will see you soon, hopefully, on my own podcast.
See you later.
See you then. Take care.
So there you go. Thank you very much for listening. And also, of course, to Ben for joining us this week on the podcast. That's about it from us for this week. Have a good week, everybody, and we will see you next time.